Okay. Back to globular clusters. We heard a bit about it yesterday from Dick Manchester and Andrew Lyne both. This has been a favorite topic of mine, as many of you know, and the reasons are many and varied, so I'm only going to really touch on ones here that are hopefully more relevant to the workshop at hand. It's motivated, of course, by what we've been waiting for a long while, namely some Chandra data on these things, which has been the holy grail for some of us and is finally starting to appear. So I will show you a, to me at least, very beautiful image of 47 Tuck, but you're going to have to wait for it because I'm going to keep you in suspense. Maybe I should just show it now and we could get on with it. Oh, come on. Because there are some relevant points along the way that I want to make. Come on, John. Hang on. We'll get there. Hopefully it's worth waiting for. So globular clusters, of course, are clearly wound up with pulsars and millisecond pulsars in particular. They are fascinating to a number of us because they're these beautifully closed system laboratories. Not that we understand what's going on, but at least in principle, if we beat at them long enough and have data like Chandra and HST and others to play with, we can hopefully make headway in understanding where these things come from, whether the standard birth rate scenarios or production mechanisms, standard spin-up models are correct, whether we need things like AIC, which a number of us have talked about. Let me quickly give you the punchline there. I don't think that the Chandra data or the HST data are going to require AIC. Sri will be relieved. We had a debate about that once. But there are some very troubling open questions, so we're not out of the woods yet. But the numbers of things that look like neutron star systems are sufficient that probably the standard picture is okay. But we might also, and I will try to touch on a few of these points at the end, but in case I don't, let me make a couple of them now, have the possibility with a large sample of these things in clusters where we have all the usual advantages of known distance to learn something about the pulsar mechanisms themselves. All the MSPs in the field that I'm waiting to hear from the real experts here, but to me at least, very uncertain distances. We're all over the place in trying to understand some of the basic, even emission mechanisms in the X-ray band. And here we have some hope of tackling this. So I'll go through very quickly, because I think this is old hat to most of us here, why the X-ray binaries are relevant to this whole story. Touch on some of the older results that really have set the stage here, ROSAT results in particular, on two clusters in particular, NGC 6397, that as I said yesterday, I was delighted to hear has finally got its first MSP. It's got a load of CVs, and I'll show you a few quiescent LMXB candidates in it. But that cluster, to jump to one of the punchlines, may have a bit of a population problem. And then, of course, the real gold mine, 47 Tuck. But along the way, there's another cluster that we've looked at. By the way, the data here, I'm just going to show you data from these three clusters that we've been working on. The 6397 and 47 Tucker GTO data that I've got with Chandra. This is from a GEO program that I'm doing on a survey of the remaining clusters in which the bright LMXBs had not been identified. And we've, in just a very short snapshot on this one, testimony to Chandra that we've all seen many times, not only identified the LMXB, so we've cleaned up the last one of the not terribly obscured ones. The only ones left for the aficionados here are the Terzin clusters that we're going to have a devil of a time ever seeing through the fog to identify. But in the same short snapshot, a couple of low luminosity sources, one of which looks like a dead ringer for a bona fide quiescent LMXB. This acronym will appear over and over here. And then we'll get on to the real meat of the stuff here, the Chandra results. And by the way, the results really are very much in preliminary form. We're just doing a paper now on 47 Tuck, a first paper. The 6397 stuff I'm going to show you is really brand new data. In fact, I just saw it literally for the first time in the last few days. So that's not been digested, but I can give you a few quick impressions. Well, this is familiar, I'm sure, to all of us, the high luminosity sources. This wonderful fact that they're overabundant in clusters means that globular clusters are, of course, factories for making these things. The same thing was realized early on to be true for pulsars, and of course it's been part of the millisecond pulsars and a key part of the argument for the connections between them. What has been a bit of a debate all along, or at least in the last 10 years or so, is what fraction of these low-mass X-ray binaries, and by the way, they're all low-mass systems, of course. We don't have any high-mass companions in globular clusters anymore. So they're all LMXBs, and they all contain neutron stars, these bright systems, which are still only known in 12 globulars. That number hasn't changed in nearly 8 or 9 years. It seems to be a fairly complete number. They're all neutron stars because they all burst. There are no black holes. I think I'm remembering this paper of Sterl's, wherever Sterl is here, and Stein, Sigurdsson, and a few others made the same point, that the black holes that we might have had in globular clusters, along with the neutron stars, for whatever IMF you like to think was there when the clusters formed, have by and large kicked each other out. Perhaps one or two binaries, you know, a bully binary survives at the bottom of the cluster. But we'd see no evidence for these things in the X-ray data. That's still certainly the case. Nor do we see, and it's going to be an interesting statistic to think about a little more, it's something that Alan Lightman and I thought about years ago, any clusters with two bright LMXBs simultaneously present, which is a little bit surprising because one of the statistics that some of you know and the rest can pick up right here is that if you want to grossly oversimplify, every cluster contains at least one quiescent LMXB. Some of them, like 47 Tuck, contain many tens, perhaps as many as 100. But there's typically at least one. They're active about 10% of the time. So with of order 10 clusters, we have some reasonable probability that two of them should have been active or on at any one time. We've never seen that, which is a little bit of an embarrassment, perhaps, but we'll let that go for the moment. So the real action in this story is with the low luminosity sources, the ones that we found way back when in the Einstein survey. This was Paul Hertz's thesis work, and which have been the subject of a lot of work with ROSAT and now with Chandra. The fact that these sources are typically a factor of 100 to a factor of 10 to the 4 less luminous than the bright systems led early on to us suggesting that they were dominated by CVs, just the very simple scaling argument in luminosities proportional to typical white dwarf neutron star radii. Of course, if they if the clusters contain these transient systems that go into quiescence, the so-called QLMXBs, then those may dominate the population. This is what Frank Verbund and others have argued for many years. And if one just stops right here and talks about the high luminosity end of these faint sources, one would conclude that the neutron star binary systems are dominant. So this has been a point of contention for the last decade or more. And the punchline is that both of them are there. This has been emerging already from ROSAT, but I think now with Chandra and HST, we're seeing it even more. So the question then is, how many of these quiescent LMXBs are there per cluster? I've just mentioned that the typical numbers are probably at least one, but that's the number that is relevant for understanding the millisecond pulsar birth rate problem and whether we have the right mixture of sources. There's another point of interest. I don't know where that Y came from there, but that can be ignored. This is something that I think Lars here and Bob Rutledge and others are particularly interested in. Certainly we are too. That if we can identify uniquely the systems that really are neutron stars, and this again has been a lot of the uncertainty, they're difficult to distinguish, by the way, those who've thought about what a disk around a neutron star accreting at very low rate versus around a white dwarf looks like. These are very subtle distinctions, and I'm not sure that we still have it totally nailed down, although the clues are getting there. But if we know that we have neutron stars, then we can, by looking at the spectra, the very close to black body-like spectra, the sort of spectra that George and others have developed nice models for, hydrogen atmosphere models, we can get very nice measures of neutron star radii without the distance ambiguities that we have in trying to do this in the field. So that's something that we certainly hope to do with these data. Let me just quickly speed up through the history to get on with the data. that not only are these systems there in significant numbers, there are systems that were found in studies that we've done mostly with HST, actually. Adrian Kuhl and Peter Edmonds in our group have done most of this work, that looked to be direct evidence in this cluster that we've worked long and hard on, 6397, to be helium white dwarfs, which would be the logical optical companions, given what we know about millisecond pulsar binary companions in the field, to be millisecond pulsars in this cluster. And what I'll show you in just a few minutes here is that indeed, given what we see in both 47 Tuck and now 6397 with just this very first quick look, this is very likely the right interpretation. They are there in the Chandra data as X-ray sources with luminosities similar to what we're seeing the millisecond pulsars in 47 Tuck to show up at. So indeed, that was the right hypothesis, not surprisingly. And finally, what we are still working on, and it's relevant to some of the stuff I'll show you, is a very deep HST, H-alpha data set on this same old 6397. The paper is nearly, a couple of papers are nearly done on reporting a significantly larger number of CVs and these helium white dwarf candidates, all of which can now be matched up with the Chandra data. Okay, so on to the Chandra results. I said I would show you quickly along the way a cluster 6652, which isn't everybody's most immediately familiar telephone number, but one that is one of those 12, and one for which optical counterparts have been sought. Mainly Eric Deutsch and Bruce Margon and company have worked hard in this cluster and proposed, on the basis of a ROSAT position with, these are the sort of typical ROSAT versus Chandra differences, 10 arc second positional uncertainties. The ROSAT experts in the room will say, well, why was the ROSAT position that bad? The answer was, this was a short observation of ours years ago, and it didn't have sufficient exposure to get Bohr sighting sources in the field, so you're stuck with the absolute ROSAT positional uncertainties. And in that rather large ROSAT error circle, Eric Deutsch proposed that this object down here, I'm labeling here now what we know from Chandra to be the real results, but this was proposed to be the counterpart for this error circle. This is the 2 sigma 10 arc second radius ROSAT error circle for the bright LMXB. Remember, this is a luminous source, 10 to the 36 burst source, persistent source. What we have seen with Chandra, and I'll show you the image in the next view graph here, is that in fact it was there, but just frustratingly on the very edge of this frame of data. It's that star right there that is the counterpart. The beauty of Chandra, of course, is you have a half arc second position in one go, and you know, bingo, what it is. The colors, as you'll see in a second, are consistent with that being the LMXB. And this thing, which they had pointed out as a very interesting star, is indeed an interesting star, but it's a quiescent LMXB. It's a low luminosity system. And in addition to that, there are two more. Well, let me show you the view graph here in the next go that are in the same field.
So if you look at the Chandra CNC position directly, what do you do?
These positions are, in fact, straight out of our colleagues down the hall. In this case, they were very close to within one or two. They're not always, certainly, but they can be. But here we had a number of sources to bore sight on. This is the Chandra image, and if you see the scale here, you can see that we're talking, you know, just a few arc seconds apart, 5 arc seconds or so for these two faint sources that are up. I do have in the next slide another view of the cluster. These are up in the core of the cluster. This burned out thing here, this is a wavelet, smooth wave detect image for those who have been using these things, is the bright LMXB. This is a factor of 300 brighter than these guys, enormously bright. So that's the guy that's in that ROSAT error circle. And this thing down here is what Eric and company had thought was the counterpart for the bright LMXB, but it's not. And in fact, here, just quickly to show you where these things fall, this is looking at archival HST data that we've done. Peter Edmonds and a student of mine, Craig Heinke, have done this in the last month or so. There, if you can make out beyond the first row, is the bright LMXB. This is mildly interesting in being about 5 core radii out of the cluster center, which is a little bit large, but not disturbingly so, given what we see in 47 Tuck with the millisecond pulsars and what we see with the X-ray sources there. Here is the source B, as we're calling it, the one that they had thought was the counterpart for the LMXB, but is not. And here's where they all fall on a color magnitude diagram. There's the real LMXB, very typical in its absolute magnitude, about +2, for those who can recognize the turnoff there and so forth. Here is, and this is relevant to what I'm going to show you on 47 Tuck, that's why I'm taking the time to do this. This is this guy, this quiescent LMXB, wherever it's gone, which doesn't stand out as blue. Here's V minus I, it's right on the main sequence, possibly slightly red of the main sequence. Whereas the next source up here, C, the one that was the upper left of the image, is down here in a very reasonable position on the color magnitude diagram to be a CV. Here's another one that doesn't show up in, no, this is the additional fourth source. Sorry, it's just not labeled here. So these are very likely CVs in their colors, but this one, we would argue, is a quiescent LMXB. The difference being that when we have a system in quiescence with a neutron star primary, we have little or no disk, very little disk heating, very little blue light from the disk, whereas in these very likely CV systems, it's the standard picture, so we're being dominated by disk light. And that's, as I say, relevant to understanding for this cluster or for the others, how we distinguish these two categories of sources. And again, the point being which ones do we count in the bookkeeping ultimately for understanding the millisecond pulsars. So on to 6397. As I said, this is a very quick preliminary look, so I'm going to just flash it by you very quickly. But with a 49 kilosecond exposure that we've just gotten the data for, we find at least 18 sources in the central 3 arc minutes. This is to be compared with 5 in the ROSAT data. I'll show you a very muddy, quick-look image in the next view graph, but let me just finish going through this. Of those 18, we could immediately identify 9 of 11 objects that we had independently picked out from HST. The reason I'm mentioning this is that if you select these guys either in X-rays or in H-alpha, as the HST work that we've done has been, you get the same answer. We're not finding different classes of objects. These things, which we claim are CVs, we find in either search technique. I'm not sure at this early stage whether the other two are there or not, but certainly 9 of them are obviously there. And perhaps more relevant to the MSP story, to the main interest of the meeting, these helium white dwarf candidates, one of which we, I think, quite convincingly showed was a helium white dwarf, but others which we've just found photometrically are all showing up, or at least, I guess not all, at least 3 of 6, and I think the numbers could be more, this is just hot off the press, are there as Chandra sources. So, and then finally, just because I won't come back to this, this cluster, we knew this from ROSAT, but now we have an independent shot at it with Chandra, doesn't contain any bright sources, bright members of this low luminosity class. That's relevant in this distinction between the white dwarfs and the neutron stars, because typically, the quiescent neutron star systems, the things I'm calling QLMXBs here, are typically of this luminosity or higher, but they do overlap. Okay, the Chandra image, very muddy. Those who look at their image for the first time see muddy things like this. I apologize for the transparency quality, but these are the original bright ROSAT sources. Now they're all these nice little faint additional guys. This is, the scale here is about 30 arc seconds. This is all in the core. For Dick and Andrew's sake, this little protrusion off here, this will all clean up beautifully in a wave detect version, of course. That's an MSP, or what we would argue is an MSP. That's a helium white dwarf, as is that guy there, and I believe this one here. All of these are the ones that we've picked out with HST. And the luminosities, just in one go for these things, are very similar to what I'm going to show you in just the next minute or two here in 47 Tuck. a few 10 to the 30 soft X-ray luminosity. So these are faint compared with some millisecond pulsars, if that's indeed what they are in the field. But those are the sort of numbers, and again, we now have good distances that we're seeing in globular clusters. So 47 tuck, this is sort of preaching to the choir. You know, why 47 tuck? Obviously, this is what one would want to do as soon as possible. I just remind you, there's a long history, not only in the things we've been talking about here with the beautiful Parkes results, but also with ROSAT. We've worked on it. Frank and Gunter, of course, have done some very nice deep exposures. There were 9 sources in the central 2-arc minute seen with ROSAT. The 5-arc second ROSAT resolution, of course, blurs everybody together. But just to give you the sort of scale for what we knew, the 20 millisecond pulsars that Fernando has reported are all within roughly 4 core radii, the new core radius determination, which is actually the old original number that we used 12 years ago. I was amused to see on our old, in fact, our old Einstein paper, God knows how long ago, had, I think, to within 3 decimal places, the same figure that is now the new core radius, 23.6 arc seconds or whatever. But in any case, that looks to have been settled down. We know now what the scale of the cluster is, and as I think most have heard or read in Fernando's paper, the millisecond pulsars are centrally concentrated and not seen beyond 3 or 4 core radii. The X-ray sources have a very similar distribution, not surprisingly, also marked fall off beyond about 4 core radii. And finally, and this is going to be relevant to the rather significant work that we're planning to do, and I'm sure others will have access to this now, I think, just about publicly available data from Ron Gilliland, that was the enormous search for planets in 47 tuck. 8 days of continuous HST data means that we have the ultimate optical time variability database to look for all the Chandra source counterparts. I'm not going to have time to talk about what we've done there, but of the 100 sources that you'll see in the next view graph, we've identified about 30 of them already in these data. And light curves, periods are popping out. We've got probably 20 periods already for these things. So the data is very rich. Okay. Well, let's not drag this out any longer. That's the number. Okay. You can see we're, you know, it's fun to see this thing. And when it came off, of course, when it comes off the press, it was a muddy, horrible image like that 6397 one. You know, it's that mess. By the way, for those who like to think about this cluster, there's that diffuse source that we saw with ROSAT up there, which is another separate talk, and I don't have time to come back to that. But that's probably not a bow shock. I think we were wrong on that, because the cluster proper motion isn't towards the northeast, it's towards the southeast. But there's very significant diffuse emission and all sorts of possible connections with the cluster story. Well, here it is in a large, you know, zoomed out view, as it were. Here's the scale, 2 arc minutes. Those who've stared at the ROSAT image may recognize a few of the bright sources in here, but when you come in closer, as it were, on that distribution, you get a rather striking view of the center of a cluster. 109 sources in here, if you can count all the little specks. The ROSAT sources, I can't begin to pick them out, but it was like these 3 and that one and a few others. There were 9 of them in here. This is 2 arc minutes on a side. This may be, I don't know, somebody can, maybe Pat or somebody from our neck of the woods can comment, but as far as I know, this might be the most rich Chandra source field yet. I'm not sure if there have been others. The center of M31, I don't think, has sources quite this crowded, but I may be wrong. In any case, it's obviously within 2 arc minutes. I think there are, well, yeah. This, if you back out and look at this, the last view, you can see these are obviously concentrated. So it looks like a globular cluster, which is comforting. And indeed it is. And, you know, I don't think there's any convincing I need to do that these things are all cluster members, but if you do the obvious tests of looking at source densities off on either side, it's essentially nil. So these are all cluster members. Let's get to some of the quick results for what those sources look like. Let me pull this out to come back to you, although I'll quickly try to speed this up. The initial points that we can conclude from this is that we are seeing 12 of the 15 millisecond pulsars for which we got advanced positions from Fernando. We thank him and the Parkes collaboration for passing those along to us. I think they're about to be published in this very lovely paper by Fryer here. In any case, 12 of them are certainly there. They're all with luminosities in, and I somewhere along the way here quoted our canonical luminosity band, which is the old Einstein band for point of easy comparison, 0.5 to 4.5 kilovolts, all with luminosities in this range, which is a bit low compared with reported ROSAT luminosities for some millisecond pulsars in the field. So it's interesting already where these things are coming out. And as I mentioned before, those are very similar numbers to what we would argue are millisecond pulsars now in 6397, those helium white dwarfs, the binary companions, of course. I'll show you very quickly, and I guess I will speed this up because we're nearly out of time, some spectra of the brightest sources. We've taken the top 25 sources just to do some preliminary spectral fits and looked at these things. And we can see that the sources, that vast menagerie of sources, divides up into probably three classes of sources. Very soft sources, medium sources, and hard sources. Remarkable division here, right? The soft ones are very likely quiescent LMXBs. They have black body temperatures. We haven't done hydrogen atmosphere models yet on these things, but black body temperature is very similar to SEN-X4 in the field in quiescence, about a quarter kilovolt. They differ, as I've discussed with Lars here at some length, in not showing power law components. They seem to be pure soft sources. So maybe we're being fooled, but at least in their black body temperatures and their luminosities, they look very similar. There's a very large medium group, though, that look like CVs in their spectra. I think in view of the time, I'm not going to show you all the histograms. I'm just going to give you the results here. They typically have Brems spectra, 5 to 10 kilovolt Brems spectra, very typical looking sort of dwarf novae. And there are a few, a couple at least, and probably more, that are extremely hard power laws. And those, I would guess, are probably also undiscovered millisecond pulsars. They're much brighter than the Parkes objects. The 12 Parkes objects are all very faint. They're all less than 20 counts in these data, between 10 and 20 counts. And those are not sufficient to do any meaningful spectral fits. We can do hardness ratios. They look moderately hard, but we're not really done with that. But there are a group of sources that are extremely hard and don't look anything like the typical CVs or quiescent LMXBs. And my bet is that those are probably more millisecond pulsars. Okay, let me just show you one or two distributions and I'll finish up here, you know. Of those 25 brightest sources where we can do something with a spectra and therefore say something about luminosities, one of the first things I'm sure any of us would want to know, how do they distribute luminosity? Here's the way they come out in this band. You can see steeply rising below 10 to the 32. I don't know if this is not significant given there are only 25 sources on this plot, or there should be. So most of the sources we haven't done this for. These are just ones that we've done spectral fits for. If I show you instead of, and I don't think I will in view of the time, hardness ratios of the 25 brightest sources, a rather muddy looking plot, but coded from soft to hard. Two very soft sources, the ones I was mentioning, are good prospects to be quiescent LMXBs. A large group of yellow guys here, which are the sort of, quote, CVs, things that look like typical Brems spectra. A couple of, and it didn't come out blue in this representation, I don't know what happened, white, but they're meant to be blue. Very hard sources. I guess I couldn't draw white on the white view graph. Okay, I think we are out of time. I'm going to jump straight to the conclusions. Getting to the conclusion, just mention one other thing that is certainly one of the many, and there are any number of things that are fascinating about these data. The temporal characteristics are another whole story. They are all highly variable, almost without exception. One of those two bright QLMXBs, as I'm calling it, looks as expected, fairly constant, but even it has a small 10% or so variation, although fighting counting statistics. Remember, this is, well, this actually is quite bright, even for Chandra. This is, there's 4,000 counts in this source, in the 75 kilosecond observation. So this is possibly getting interesting, but on the whole, this is what we would expect a quiescent LMXP to look like. But here, just one last transparency, is the other one of those two very soft sources. Remarkable dip-like behavior. This is down to zero. Count rates down to zero here. Dip here, dip here, dip here. 8 hour sort of time scales. I don't know whether we're seeing the analog of dips that we see in bright LMXBs, whether we're seeing material. These are not sharp eclipses. This is going down, up, and down again. They look to me like dips that we see in compact binaries. We see several sources like this. There may be some interesting questions having to do with the distribution of inclinations. Punchline, final slide, and then I will stop, is that we are undoubtedly seeing some things that look like the expected millisecond pulsar progenitors, at least two. There could be many, many more, but the ones that so far contain the right flavor of spectra, although not variability, are this sort of number. We're seeing a significant number of things that look like CVs. We see virtually all of the thus far detected parks millisecond pulsars. There's obviously the potential for a large number of the 75 or so sources that I haven't accounted for here to be any one of these three groups. A conservative, very early estimate, and you can see we're just in the midst of this, is that probably at least half of the other 75 are millisecond pulsar contenders. Fernando and Dick and company have suggested that given the 20 detected millisecond pulsars, there probably is a reservoir of order 100 or 200. We may be seeing most of those here. But there is also the possibility, given the hardness ratios and spectra, that a significant number of those are accreting white dwarfs. I think I better stop there and take questions. And I'll put up the one slide I didn't get to, the radial distribution of the X-ray sources, indistinguishable from the millisecond pulsars, but, as one might have expected, very distinguishable from horizontal branch stars. This is would have been surprising if it was anything else, but a KS test, if you can make out these not very distinguishable distributions, shows that the X-ray sources, the CV-like ones, or the QLMXB-like ones, are all consistent with the millisecond pulsar distribution, consistent with 1.5 solar mass objects, totally distinguishable from the 0.7 solar mass or 0.6 solar mass stars. Okay, that's really it. Yeah. Well, ASUS data are confined to 3-second integrations, so the answer is no. We would like to do this cluster with a very deep HRC pointing to do sub-second timing.
Sorry, not millisecond pulsations, but
longer period pulsations. Yes, in the case of those brighter guys, we do, and we're doing that. There are several thousand counts in the bright sources. We haven't. We're just too early to decide. The definite or the known millisecond pulsars, the Parkes pulsars, very little, only hardness ratios. We've only got 10 or 20 counts typically in these, so we can't do proper spectral models. But as I did say, they do look moderately hard. Yes. And so that's the basis for the claim that the several much brighter sources that are extremely hard, I would bet, are just more luminous millisecond pulsars. Yeah.
For the millisecond pulsar, we have, for those who came in the family, do you think that fully according to these modules, the size, you get the pulsar? How many ones?
No, not. There's no time resolution to do pulsation. But we can look for, and we do plan to look for, on your binary ephemeris, any modulations. And we're also jumping ahead a bit here, but we're also looking at this rich Gilliland HST data set for optical variations. But for pulsations from the X-ray sources themselves, it's not in these data.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, the luminosity class doesn't have to be determined by active
radiation. Sure. No, I know. Your picture is incandescence, obviously. And the reason I was making the comment about variability is that, of course, argues against that, unless we're seeing just eclipsing or dip-like origins of variability. But
it's important, though, the required luminosity is determined by the primary accretion rate of the neutron star.
Yeah. True, yeah. Yeah. Just a quick response to that, though. Most of the other sources, as far as we've been able to see at this still rather early stage, are also variable. So we do not see a class of sources that would be the sort of objects that I think you're really suggesting, which are the incandescent type sources that look rock steady and are not variable. There may be some in there, but that's certainly not most of them, which is why I think most of these intermediate guys are certainly accretion powered, and they are accreting. We'll know from the optical counterparts for those that have them, but my guess is that many of them are CVs. Yeah.
Can you repeat the questions?
Oh, sorry, sure. Yeah.
What is this distance is now the 6397 and 4740?
6397 is 2.3 kiloparsecs, and 47 tuck has gone up by 10% for reasons that I don't remember, but it's gone up to 5 kiloparsecs, maybe somebody knows. So they're roughly a factor of 2. So we're getting a bit lower down in luminosity in 6397, although the exposure wasn't quite as long. It was 50 kiloseconds instead of 75. It's also got a bit more NH, which doesn't help for these soft sources. Sri. Or, sorry. Yeah.
Maybe I didn't understand. You said this quiescent elements is they don't have disks. Is that what you said?
Well, there are two possible. The question. I'm sorry. I wasn't repeating the questions. The quiescent LMXBs don't have disks.
I thought that's what you said.
I said that along the way because one class, let's call it that, of quiescent LMXBs are those for which accretion is totally shut off. In which case. The hot neutron star surface. This is what Lars and Bob have been talking about.
Right, but is that the kind of spectrum you think that would be?
That's what the two most luminous guys are roughly consistent with. Very soft black bodies. The trouble, as I mentioned a couple times, with those two luminous ones is that they're variable. Or one of them is highly variable, probably absorption-like events. The other one may or may not be variable.
So in the 6397 case, your source B, which is next to the main sequence, is that also
in,
soft X-ray?
In 6652, oh, yeah.
Okay, the first, yes.
Right.
Is that a soft X-ray source?
That one, we don't know. I guess I didn't mention, those data were HRC data. We know nothing about the spectrum for 6652. 6397, where we have a whole nest of these things, we will be able to do spectra. But none of those look constant either. So I think we have a bit of a problem with the incandescence picture and not finding most of these things to be rock steady, in which case there still is accretion going on or something that's modulating them.
Yeah. Behind you.
Yes, Vicki.
I have a few questions. One is, you mentioned possibly doing a deep HRC observation with a 47 tuck, and I'm wondering, given the technical problems with the HRC, will finding pulsation in sources where the curious zones be possible? And also, if so, is it remotely feasible to look for unknown curious zones?
I don't know if anybody here was on the TAC, but we did propose this in the last cycle, and my friends or spies or whatever tell me that we came out very high or at the top or whatever in the panel, but my colleagues down the hall, who shall go nameless on the so-called merging panel, shot us down for just the reason you're worried about, but I think incorrectly. The worries were that the higher background in HRCS would limit our ability to look for pulsations. I don't think they were right, and so I will betray my plans here that we'll propose this again. But we proposed a very deep 300 kilosecond observation, which should have been able to detect, given that we know the ephemeris for these 12 guys, I think we would have been able to set very interesting limits or detections on pulsations in those. As for blind searches, no. With 20 or 30 photons in an unknown period, I think we're out of luck. Cyril. The question was the reference to helium white dwarfs, what did I mean and why does that connect with millisecond pulsars? It's just the argument that those are the binary companions, as one sees in the field. And for the one case where we, or at least binary companions for many of them, binary companions for millisecond pulsars. Perhaps, but the one that we have that we did an HST spectrum on looked to be from its velocity in a binary system with an unseen companion that was certainly consistent with being a neutron star. This is all in a paper by Edmonds et al. From a year or two ago. So it's a series of indirect arguments, and the claim that I made that we now would say this is supported is based on this very early Chandra data showing that these objects are all showing up as X-ray sources with luminosities very comparable to what we see in 47 Tuck for known millisecond pulsars. It's a long story, but in a nutshell, they were selected as H-alpha absorbers. The same H-alpha search technique looking for CVs is also sensitive for broad absorption line objects. That plus the colors allows one to find these things. And in one case that we did an FOS spectrum, that's where the real evidence came. Well, who knows? I mean, you know, we're selecting these things photometrically. We had an HST spectrum of one of them. All I'm saying is now that we have found four or five of these stars in 6397, and they're virtually all showing up as low luminosity X-ray sources, that I would bet that these are indeed the companions of millisecond pulsars, just as one sees in the field. But there's a chain of inferences there that I've had to skip over. Yeah. I wish I knew, except that it's a massive cluster. It's, of course, not core collapsed, so it hasn't burned all its binaries. That must have something to do with it. It's got this... one of the things I would love to have been able to talk more about was the comparison of these two clusters. There's a factor of 10 difference in their mass by most estimates. The numbers of millisecond pulsars, who knows what you guys will eventually find, but from this early glimpse at the X-ray data, the numbers are roughly consistent with a factor of 10. We see a few, and we could see as many as of order nearly 100 in 47 Tuck. So my guess is that it's the first order mass, and maybe that's by far the most important thing, because 6397 is core collapse, as you know, and therefore should have burned through a lot of its binaries, whereas 47 Tuck has not. So it may be that mass is the big factor, but there are undoubtedly other things like initial mass function that the 6397 case looks to be possibly different in its ratio of things that look like quiescent LMXBs to things that look like CVs. So there may well be differences.
Last question.
Yeah.
Two questions.
Yes.
Does the fact that we're not the binary in 47 Tuck has an orbital period longer than 2.3 days, does that tell you anything about the history of the density of the core? Because there are no obvious selection effects against finding periods of 1 month. There is a paper by Brazio, Fowler, Brazio, mm-hmm. that says mm-hmm. that you should have formed binary periods of about 1 month. And the other question is, talking to Fred Brazio, he was very surprised by the fact that we don't find any NSPs at the distance larger.
Three or four core radii.
Three or four core
right,
radii.
Right.
And you see the same thing for
yes.
X-ray
sources. Yes.
Is that surprising to you? Or?
No, I think you guys showed this was consistent with the with an isothermal distribution. Sorry? You would, and that's another whole interesting topic. In 6397, we may, I think, be seeing evidence for that. But in 47 Tuck, I thought this was consistent with just an isothermal distribution. And
yeah, the isothermal distribution is 1 over R squared.
Sure.
It doesn't have a,
yeah, a cutoff. Yes, right.
Yeah. There is no clear cut M to the distribution.
Yeah.
There's like Fred was saying that essentially you see, should see pulsars on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And this region is quite difficult to explain these spectral.
Yes, I agree. It's not surprising that they're similar, but I agree there are some interesting points as to what is really driving this cutoff. As to the binary period cutoff, I don't have any further comments over what you mentioned. What it's possible that one could keep longer period systems together. They wouldn't have broken up. I don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. We should stop here.
Yep.
Let's thank all the speakers and